Yeah, well, I am. What do you think Whitley would make of it if he were to read it?
What's that?
Well, it's a kind of an impossible question. It's a rhetorical question, but what would Whitley make of this if he were to read it,
Well,
I wonder?
I remember the when he read that other piece of yours from several years ago.
Yeah.
I remember, he just thought that you were trying to completely tear him down and, just, rip his credibility to shreds. And to me, that was not the point of your piece whatsoever. And I remember being really disappointed that he completely missed the much more subtle content that you were conveying.
Well, yeah, same here.
And of course, his fans, came out like rabid pack of dogs, it seemed like,
Yeah,
so.
that was what happened then. That's right. And this time so far, the fans have just stayed away from it. And Whitley, if he's seen it, has not commented.
Like, to me, it was like, oh my gosh, this guy, he's like, got Whitley Strieber, and like, I think you brought up Castaneda in there and some others, and I was like, this is cool shit. I'm gonna read this. You're putting all this stuff together. Yeah, this is my kind of thing. So, I don't know. I want to find more people like that that are, more, I guess, more open-minded and haven't made up their minds yet about things.
Well, I mean, this certainly Strieber is likely to see this whole project this way, and I doubt very much if he'd even be able to read all of it because it would probably be so disturbing to him. But I just specifically this area around Paine and the summer of '68 and his involvement with the Process Church, it's like a pyramid that's been poking out above the surface for decades, and that nobody's taken the time or had the, I don't know
Now,
what you want to say, courage or determination to uncover.
I mean, I'm now in what I'm thinking since I the things that I learned from Chapter 7, that there is this audio recording of him under hypnosis with Hopkins that apparently has been made at least semi-publicly available, because you have a copy of it.
Subscribers, yeah.
Okay, well, that's semi-publicly available, I guess.
Yeah.
Then there is the text of Paine, and then there is an audio recording of him reading it as well as commenting on it. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So it's almost kind of like he's. To me, I kind of want to, like, I'm not that I'm probably not going to do this, but if I could somehow call up Whitley, I'd be like, Whitley, you got some explaining to do. What's going on here with Summer of 68 and the content of Paine? And, like, I think you got some explaining to do. Can you come clean on this, please? That's what I'm thinking at this point.
Do you have a history of migraines?
Especially when I was a kid, yeah, I saw doctors for them. I got prescription medication for them. Used to make me vomit and I'd black out when I was a child.
Wow. Like what?
I it's pretty much been under control basically since my late teens, early 20s, when I moved out of my parents' house and was in general. Well, one thing I always correlated with was after that I was in charge of my own dietary intake, and it wasn't eating what they were eating anymore. I don't know why that seemed like such a big deal, but that's always been in my mind that way. I stopped having the migraine headaches so frequently, and they stopped being so undoing. But occasionally they'll still come on even now, and can really put me out for a couple of days.
I was reading about, or rather, having read to me about migraines just yesterday, coincidentally from Jonathan Lessem novel, and he described migraine as, I don't remember the terms he used, but just that it, when he had a migraine, it felt like he was kind of in a tunnel and just totally unable to connect to his surroundings or himself, like he was a sort of a ghost version of himself. Do you
It
have
is kind of
anything?
like that. Yeah, it's very devitalizing. It's definitely feel kind of hollow, and really it's really hard to get interested and engage in almost anything. That it just feels like there's a, like someone's taking a saw right to your face is what it feels like.
Because my stepfather suffered from migraines, so I heard about them when I was growing up. I was familiar with the term, but I always just understood it as a severe headache. But hearing this description of Lethem, I mean, the reason that my wife read it to me was because it reminded her of how I describe, my experience when I'm, I call it the Grinch, when I'm Grinch, when I'm suffering from symptoms of chronic fatigue, and that involves head pains, but also
Gotcha.
throat
Sure.
pains, body pains. But it's like a metaphysical condition. It's more than just physical. And that description was very close to it. It's like being kind of sealed in a box or trapped in a spider's web or something, and unable to actually
Yeah, like being trapped in
function.
a spider's web, that's a pretty good like analogy, I would say too. Yeah.
Well, and so do you, I know you did in your email, but to what extent do you see it as being related to reading the stream of material?
I don't know that it I don't know there's anything in particular, and I'm not even clear that it's so. However, I know that the more I kept stressing about trying to make a decision about what should I do consciously about the memories from my childhood that are starting to like creep out, and just kind of what should I do? What should I do about it? Should I read the next chapter? I want to read the next chapter. And it's like the more I kept debating and not making a decision, then the worse I started feeling physically. And for about a week or so, like it felt like my lungs were all filled with something, like it was hard to breathe, or there was a lot of pressure on my chest all the time. And then eventually that became more of like, a literal pain in the head and neck. And that's when I started focusing on the body, and I stopped debating about what I should do or shouldn't do, just focusing on the pain. I
Right.
almost hate to use that word now, but as soon as I did that, then I was just feeling gratitude and relief from not being in pain, and I wasn't really thinking about debating about things whether or not anymore.
As soon as you focused on the pain.
Right. Instead of my thoughts about, what should I do or shouldn't do or whatever.
Focusing on the pain relieved it to some extent.
Yeah, focusing on my physical well-being, I guess, yeah.
I mean, I'm wary of interpreting your experience, but at the same time, it's the first thing that's coming to my mind is that and I'm speaking about my own experience here, or at least my own interpretation of my
Sure.
experience, that by focusing on Streber for me, it is also stirring up memories, but not as dramatically as you've described. Like you've actually, it sounded like you'd actually began to think about specific periods or incidents in your past
Yeah, yeah.
with new eyes. And I haven't necessarily had that, but that might be partly because I've been looking at Streber for longer in this way. But what I have had is, or what I do wonder whether it's happening is, if by putting my attention on Streber's narrative, Streber's history, Streber's experience, and the effect it's had on his psyche, which is what the piece is about, more than the experiences themselves, I'm it kind of indirectly, and maybe the only way I can, putting my attention also on the mirroring or the corresponding experiences in my own life and imprints on my psyche. And if that isn't stirring up memories that are somatic memories.
Yeah.
And so then I don't know about the only, but maybe the primary or the initial way to experience them is as symptoms.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm pretty sure I did. Like, it was soon after I started reading it at all. I can't remember exactly what chapter. I could probably find out if I went back through a notebook or something, but I think it was in April. And I had an experience one night, and it was like the first time really that like memories started to come up, and I really started to question about what had really happened. And what was interesting was that it at the time it felt like it was something exterior to me had triggered it, which was a very bizarre incident over at a friend's house where someone I didn't really know came in like almost falling down drunk and caused a big scene. It was sort of when that was blowing up right there in the physical environment that I started feeling really overwhelmed by these physical symptoms. And then in my head, I was just, I don't even know why, I started focusing on this event from my childhood. And it was just like, what is going on? This is really bizarre.
So you're saying that while you were reading the material, something apparently unrelated happened in your environment, and then that seemed to trigger symptoms in your body.
Yeah. It wasn't here in where I live. It was during the space of time that I began to get into the material, and I was over visiting some friends at their house, and a friend of theirs who I don't really know came in, and so forth and so on. And at the same time that was going on, like, I felt really overwhelmed and just really kind of out of my body in a way that I used to feel as a child, going through migraines and blacking out and vomiting and whatnot. So it had a really similar sort of feeling to it, as it, and so I guess that kind of makes a lot of sense why the memories were in my head were of the same time period, although at the time I just couldn't put that all together consciously.
And was there something about the event that you were witnessing that had some sort of correspondence for you?
Well, I don't know directly, but I will I what un upset me about the experience that was going on right there in the room was that he was clearly like, I mean, he had just driven over there, and he had obviously been driving drunk, and it was just like, it felt like a loaded gun was in the room and didn't know where it was going to go off or which direction it was going to go off in. And so there was something about, like this ambiguous masculine presence where, where it seemed like violence could erupt at any moment, and for unknown reasons, especially because there's intoxication is going on. I don't know how that fits in specifically with anything, but that was definitely at the same time, felt like the trigger. But the incident that I was focusing on that in my mind that night was as an incident when I was over at a friend's house as a child. I believe it was someone's birthday party, and I just the memories from then are just like really few, and I've always been aware that there was something strange about that afternoon or evening, because I remember being at the party, and then the next thing I remember, I'm waking up on the couch at my house, and it's dark outside, and the party's been over for hours, and I don't know how I got back to my own house or what had just happened over the last preceding hours.
What age was this?
6, 7, 8.
Did you say in an email that you've first seen communion in the supermarket at age 6? Did I imagine that?
I think that was about age 8. But yeah, it was at the supermarket. The supermarket's no longer there, but I remember exactly where it was, as a matter of fact. And after, as soon as I saw the cover, I decided I had to read it, and I found it at the local library and read it.
But at age 8,
Yeah.
that's very precocious of you.
Yeah. It's interesting. As I read earlier, I read the article you have on Reality Sandwich, and then I dove into chapter 7, and I started thinking about, not that I really have a concrete idea about what may or may not have happened at these incidents in my childhood, but just in general, things like that and things around that I'm beginning to recognize were more formative as far as the whole direction the rest of my life took, basically. And that would have been around age 6. I was definitely experiencing some, I keep using the phrase, out of body experiences during migraine episodes. I don't really know how legit that expression is, but ever since I, when later on in life I heard about that, I think from Robert Monroe, I connected it to that in my mind. If that's legit or not, I don't know. But for better or for worse, I'm probably going to keep using that phrase just because I've been using it for so long, at least in my own mind. And I remember around age 6 trying to describe to my mother what I was experiencing, and her insisting that I was lying to her in some way, and I must stop this lying, and Jesus doesn't love liars, and she can't believe that I would lie like this, and it was like, it left me really bewildered as far as how to effectively express what I was experiencing. If, you know, I'm trying to express it and I'm being told that I'm lying about something when I'd like, it's like, no, I'm, you know, maybe I don't know what I'm experiencing, but I am experiencing this and I'm trying to express it. And that really left a big imprint, as it kind of told me, like, okay, mom's not someone safe to tell these things to, you know. But, you know, that's a pretty young, I realize in hindsight, it's a pretty young age to, like, have that kind of thought in one's head. And to already be, you know, considering what is safe to share with my parents or not.
Yeah, although I think it's unusual to remember that as a coherent memory or thought, but I would guess that it's a very common, if not universal, experience of children.
It was such a big deal to me. I remember in my 20s trying to ask my mother about it, and she insisted that she had no memory of the event and kind of got upset about me asking about it. And so then I formed the opinion or whatever from her statement then that it was of so little importance to her that she didn't even remember it, yet I had blown it up into like this enormous thing for the rest of my childhood and adolescence. And so, of course, that, you know, set me off on all kinds of trains of thinking about, you know, human beings and psychology, too. But that's a whole other story.
Right. So when you say you'd blown up the incident, you mean the moment of realization that you couldn't trust your mother?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that was a really big deal. And like, I guess I always assumed that my mother would have always remembered it, too, because it was such a big deal to me. It just made sense that it must be a big deal to the other person, too.
Right.
But it was, you know, it was apparently something everyday and trivial to her, which is now I understand is totally understandable and probably totally reasonable. But it was a big deal to me, and I guess in some ways it always will be, because it seemed to have started to shape, you know, the direction I was going to take later on in life.
It's kind of an archetypal scene that you're describing. I mean, we see it in movies all the time, maybe not as extreme as that, but sometimes in a benevolent way, telling the child there's no such thing as monsters to comfort it, but sometimes more the way you're describing it, where a child's being reprimanded for telling lies. And of course, in the context of the movie, we know that the child isn't lying, right?
Right. Now, I remember it clearly. I remember exactly where we were at in the kitchen and in the house and what time of day, and it was
wow.
It's really vivid to me.
So we're talking about three incidents that were roughly in the same time period, between 6 and 8, roughly. Is that right?
There was, yeah, it's all, and then, I mean, there's definitely some overlap with things that happened closer to like age 9 and 10, too. But it's still a pretty narrow window.
Well, for me, it's a key period, A, because that's when my memories proper begin. Like, I don't remember anything like pre-6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And okay. B, because I have a specific memory of being 8, which I remember how old I was, because it was actually about being 8. I was with my best and perhaps only close friend at that time, who was also 8. I still know him. And we were running through the village and just exuberant for whatever reason. And we agreed between us that 8 was absolutely the best thing to be, and that we wanted to be 8 for forever, that we kind of made a pact, if that's not putting it too strongly. It wasn't ritualistic, but we might have shook on it or something, but we reached this agreement that we were always going to stay 8. So I remember that acutely, and I wonder to what extent, you know, they say childhood pacts, they're effective. So it's almost as though the time in my life pre that is sort of sealed away in this bubble of forgetting. That's the way I keep it pristine.
That's, oh wow! I didn't connect it like that immediately, but now I got it. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I feel like I remember all kinds of things from pretty early on, but at the same time, like, pretty early on, I formed this opinion that it was really important to remember everything as much as possible, because it seemed to be all kinds of things I needed to figure out on my own or something.
Well, that could have to do with what you experience with your mother. I mean, if you were aware.
Right. No, it definitely did. Yeah, absolutely. That and the one other thing I'll never forget, and this was in my mind earlier, and it's, maybe it sounds a little silly, but and I guess it's to me, I say that because to me it sounded silly, and I hadn't really thought about it consciously for a long time, but it was really upsetting at the time. I was around 9 or 10, and it was the time that my father decided to tell me that there was no such thing as Santa Claus. Well, I pretty much already figured that out, of course, you know. But then it was like after he was done with that, it really hit me that, wait a minute, if my own parents, who claim to, like, you know, love me more than anything in the world, could lie and deceive me about something like this for like 9 or 10 years, who the fuck can I trust? How do I know that people aren't just making, you know, telling me all kinds of stories all the time? And I haven't thought about that in a long time, but it once again it reinforced, oh, I should be really careful about what I share with my own parents.
And
And by extension with everybody in the whole world.
they were presumably also telling you that God existed.
Oh, you betcha. Oh, you betcha. All kinds of stuff about that, very much.
So did you wonder about that as well? Like if they've made up Santa Claus, maybe they made up God and they're going to tell me later about
It
that
took
one.
me about till age 12 to start wondering about that. And that's around the time that I started taking seriously that it seems like it should be my business to find out whether it's true or not, because obviously I can't trust anyone else to tell me the I laugh now, but man, I took this really seriously for many years, as you know.
Yeah, well, it is serious business for a child. I mean, it's existential, like trying to find the ground.
Yes. Yeah.
Like what's real and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I would say we're still, well, I mean, I can't speak for you, but we're speaking together, so my guess is that we're probably fairly similar, because I think everybody is, to be honest, but I'm certainly more and more acutely aware, actually, of how I don't really know where the ground is. I don't know what's true. I don't know what's real.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I will always be questioning that and seeking that till the day I die. And at the same time, I'm okay with that now. And I recognize that I do get a lot of genuine joy out of that, as long as I don't take it so damn seriously. As long as I, you know, take the time to laugh. And I can't imagine ever giving up the quest to try to understand, regardless of the fact that I may never.
I don't think you can give it up. I think you either it either ends in defeat or it ends in victory, I suppose, not to put it in those quasi-mythical terms, but I mean,
Sure,
either
sure.
you find what you're looking for and then the quest ends, or you don't find it and it just ends when you die, I suppose, but even then, maybe not. But I do think that we are questing for something real by definition. I mean, that
Yeah, I do too.
there is ground. It's just.
Just really hard to find. A lot harder than most people even have any concept of, I think.
And I think that this is like the longer I've been working on this Streber thing, and that includes talking to people about it, and when this is one of the reasons, or maybe the main reason why I chose to do it this way, of in installments, weekly installments, and wanting to talk to people about the installments before I release them, which isn't happening in your case because of
Gotcha.
how intense it turned out for you, and so you're now kind of
Yeah.
even behind the general public, which is interesting in itself. But what was I saying? That it's been necessary or helpful for me to kind of keep revisiting the material in the process of making it public.
I think you made a great choice as far as considering it a work of art, you know, first and foremost, more than anything else, because that kind of, I think that keeps it balanced.
Yeah.
And it probably is, would make that more accessible to more readers that way too, I think.
Well, the accessibility thing is a funny thing in itself. And when I heard from you about your reaction stroke response to material and how it seemed like it was triggering stuff to the extent that you were kind of wary of returning to it or of exposing yourself to it too quickly. That confirmed this feeling I'd been having that the material was potentially triggering, explosive, threatening. My own experience of how it seems to have been affecting my health and my stability or my well-being. Like, it's been quite a grueling process working on this. So it seemed as though, like, the more effective this was as a project, even as an art project, the less easy it would be for people to enjoy it.
I see. Yeah, I see what you mean. I guess I keep thinking that, you know, that it would be a minority of people that would have, you know, reactions like being triggered. But yeah, you know, I could be completely wrong. Maybe it'd be a majority.
Well,
I have no idea.
I think that your experience is probably a way to measure or understand other people's experiences by being more extreme, by being more evident. I think my guess is,
okay,
and it has been before I heard from you, is that people are not necessarily being triggered by the material, but they're aware that at some level that it will trigger them, and so they're staying away from it or they're not connecting to it too deep
Wow.
because of
Wow.
that.
Wow.
There's the whole nature of crucial fictions is that we don't want to let go of them. That's what makes them crucial,
Yeah.
because they're crucial. So to be making a project out of exploring the crucial fictions and seeing the holes in the plots that we've adopted for our own fictions, our own, you know, identity belief systems,
Yeah.
That's not going to be entertaining to very many people. Like, it's a very exclusive kind of entertainment value, I think. I don't think that I realized how crucial they were to me. I mean, say the Strieber thing, what I was getting to a moment ago, or trying to, was that the more closely I look at this and why I'm doing it, and go over the material again and rewrite it with reader feedback, all of that process, it's allowing me to consider the question, you know, more deeply. And I think I'm starting to identify, like, really maybe not the central, but very close to the central reason that I feel the need to unravel Strieber's narrative. And that is because I was looking for some external figure and system, you know, teaching that would validate my own experiences and give them context that I could understand and help me to deal with them. And I found that in Strieber. And therefore, because I found it outside of myself, it's like looking for the surrogate father thing, it's the whole guru thing, because I found that validation and that definition outside of myself, it was false. It's always going to be false, right? You know, what
Right.
your parents showed you in a way was perhaps a good thing.
Well,
It's
sure.
a necessary thing, but at the same time, it does, well, it leaves that hole. But I think that we almost all of us have that hole that we don't get the validation that we need from our parents, and so then we take that that need for validation into adulthood, and then we're looking for it wherever we can find it, whether it's in religion or politics or this teacher or that guru or that whatever it is. And Strieber was one of those individuals that, for me, I didn't read it when I was 8. My God, I can only guess what that would have been like. You know, I was in my early 20s. I had a very different background from you also, because I was raised like with an atheist background, and we never believed in Santa Claus. Like, my Santa Claus for me was my mother stumbling drunkenly into the bedroom and swearing. You know? So there was never any illusions there.
Well, wow.
But I had whatever experiences I had as a child, I would say both magical and traumatic. I don't remember them, unfortunately, or fortunately, but whatever happened is what happened. But I was, you know, in my early 20s, I was compelled to seek out magical solutions, and Strieber was one of the providers of those solutions for me. And I, you know, I put them in my mojo bag. I made them items of my crucial fiction, which was that, yes, I was part alien, and that whatever these beings were, that they were involved with me at a deep level, and that that was the meaning behind my early nightmares and night terrors as a child, and so on. You've read the material.
Sure.
So all of that became unconsciously. I wove from that. Is it wove or weaved? I wove my own.
I'm not sure.
My own sort of cover story or embellishment or glamorization. And so now for me to try and find the ground, what did happen, not in a literal sense the incidents, but, you know, what, well, figuratively anyway, what happened, you know, what's going on in my psyche really underneath these fictions. It's a sort of natural recourse, I think, to go to Strieber as one of those individuals and see, like I say, I started this unconsciously, it's becoming consciously, but if I can deconstruct his narratives and show that they're false, then I can break the spell. You know?
Right, right, got you. That's what I got out of what you're doing, yes, totally.
So in a way, it's not really about Strieber. I mean, they may be true for him. Who knows in the end, right? What's true for somebody else? But the way I understood them and interpreted them was not true. And so that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at, you know, these are the items that affected me, and this is how I now interpret them with this growing consciousness. And if that means that, so I don't, you know, I don't want it to be about Strieber. That's the sort of irony of it. It's like with the father issue, like if you try to get free of your father or say, I'm never going to be like him, then you're still caught in that thing, right? You're negative identifying with the father.
Right, right.
So I don't want to be doing that. But at the same time, I think it's an inevitable transitional process that I'm in of letting go of external, of the need for external validators.
Yeah, it's hard to let go of that too.
Yeah, because it's like free falling. It's like if you don't actually know where the ground is, and you've just relied on these signs and indications to tell you where it is, and then you say, okay, I'm not going to rely on those anymore, then really you end up, I mean, the only choice is to accept that there may not be any ground at all.
But does that, to me, when I hear that, that equates to the incidents from childhood not having happened. But I don't think that's what you're really saying, though.
The incidents from childhood not having happened.
Right. Is that what you're, that's not, I don't believe that's what you're saying, but that's what I hear in what you just said.
Well, I think it's worse than that, because it's, I would say that not, that recognizing that we have no ground is recognizing that we don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know that what you and I are having this conversation now, not really. All I know is that I'm having a perception of something. And I don't want to get sucked into the black hole of philosophy. That seems to happen all the time with these conversations.
Yeah.
But so let's bring it back to childhood. Well, I know this, the ground of this is I know something happened to me in my childhood and it was traumatic. And I'm pretty sure it wasn't just birth, but even that, maybe that's too much.
Yeah.
You don't really need to, okay, you know, as far as I know that I'm here, I know I was born, I know that that birth was traumatic, and I know that I'm still not over it, okay? And
yeah,
that's,
totally.
I mean, that when you put that into words, it seems to make it facile is the only thing. But I suppose that's kind of the nature of the truth, is it is kind of almost frighteningly simple and unglamorous. We were born. It was horrific. It was traumatic, and we were totally powerless. And we're still trying to assimilate that experience.
That's so sometimes I've wondered, especially after reading quite a bit by Ronald Lange, whether or not basically everything that, you know, that I ever felt traumatized or confused by, whether or not that was actually coming out of incredibly vague and like really ridiculously ambiguous impressions from those very first moments out of the womb, you know, trying to make sense out of that, but in a way that, you know, we're talking about something that happened way before language or walking or having any idea what was going on in this place.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, it's really curious. Why are there certain incidents where I have complete blackouts of memory? You know, why those specific times, and why at the time did it seem related to the face on the cover of Communion and these things called UFOs?
Right.
It's, you know, I would love to try to understand more of that, but I don't know if there is, I don't know how much there is to understand there, except for just trying to grab onto something. But why would I grab onto that? Why did that face look familiar? That's so weird. That's the question I just really have no idea about.
I think, I mean, it's archetypal, I think, is, and it's maybe too simple an answer again, but if there's the collective psyche, there's a collective trauma, and then, so then there's a collective...
For lack of a better word, memory of that. Yeah, that's what, that's the only thing that makes sense to me too.
Yeah, well, I was
actually, then of course I wanted, well, what the hell was that about, you know? But how would you ever investigate that? I don't know.
Which one, the collective thing?
No, but if the image of these beings with the big black eyes that somewhat resemble human fetuses at a certain phase, if they are memories that are sort of like, you know, like sort of like cultural or like species imprints from, you know, something that happened collectively to all of our common ancestor or ancestors, then what was that that happened on Earth involving these things that looked like that? That would be, you know, that would be the next thing I'd want to investigate, but I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know about one grounds want to investigate that. I don't buy into any of that ancient aliens.
No, well, I think you don't have to reach that far out. I think it was almost maybe the beginning of an answer was in their question there, and how you mentioned how they resemble fetuses.
Yeah. No, I thought a lot about that too. But then it's,
How
many people have actually seen what a fetus looks like? Well, I mean, now we do because of photographs and all this imagery.
Well,
but
how about this? If trauma is inextricably linked to self-awareness, like when consciousness begins to split off from the whole and therefore has at least the potential to develop self-awareness.
Gotcha. I'm with you, yeah.
And if that... we also take into account the whole question of an out-of-body experience, and maybe that fetuses are consciousness that isn't confined to the body, like pre-birth and even after birth. There's a period where the consciousness isn't fully embodied, the psyche isn't fully embodied.
Localized, yeah.
Yeah. Then is it possible that with the beginnings of trauma, which could even be pre-birth, and that's my astrologically, that's what I've been told, that the worst damage that I suffered as a psyche was in the womb.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense too.
What if that initial trauma that's even pre-birth entails witnessing ourselves as a fetus in this experience.
In utero. Well, see, that is exactly what Ronald Lange talks about, is that the placenta itself, that we're conscious inside of that, just like we're conscious inside the fetus until the umbilical cord is cut. So that makes perfect sense, that because we actually can be conscious inside of that, we actually could have seen our own form in some way. I guess it wouldn't exactly be vision as we're used to with eyes, but...
Right.
Wow, I hadn't like totally come full circle with that till right now. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, all right.
rather strange experience, a close encounter, and it seemed entirely real at the time it happened, and it was very confusing because it was not something that was supposed to be possible, and it destroyed my whole paradigm, my whole model of the world was thrown into confusion because suddenly something had occurred that could not happen, and yet it had.
Behind a veil of silver scars, there is a special inverted star. He's a greasy beast heaving in a field of sticky black mud.
Science hasn't addressed the problem. They do not have the answers. Nobody has the answers. The culture has remained passive to this situation, to what I believe is a very definite reality. But since it has remained passive to it, we have never addressed it in a useful and meaningful manner, as a result of which it is entering a kind of a mythology in a dreary post-industrial folklore of people being abducted into little flying saucers into horrible little gray rooms where they're kind of vaguely sexual things done to them.
There's a jagged deep crack in the crust of the earth, spreading from north to south.
Which may or may not be true. My own experience was quite a bit like that, actually. It wasn't so different from that.
Put your light in my mouth. 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 Put your light in my mouth.
The point is. The point is.
No, I hadn't thought of it either before, so I'm not necessarily going to be able to add anything to it, but it's a kind of living example of how you can ask the questions, and if you're willing to, our tendency as intellects is to go out there and to these narratives that are already in place and something that's outside of ourselves, because we don't want to re-experience the trauma. We don't actually want to know the truth, because knowing the truth means embodying it, means experiencing it, means living it. And in this case, we're talking about reliving it, because we're talking about a truth that's trapped in the past. So if there's, basically all of our systems of thought and language and identity have actually been constructed as a way to protect us from and escape from and separate ourselves off from that initial experience of trauma, then they're going to be very ineffective in terms of using them to actually get back to that truth. They're always going to pull us in the other direction. So then we're going to start thinking about ancient astronauts and humanity collectively in history and aliens and UFOs, and it's all going to be outward.
Right, totally.
And it may not be untrue either. Strieber's whole thing of this is our future self and 2001, the floating fetus. It may be, nature is symmetrical. So there may be a future event like McKenna talks about that we're experiencing the ripples of, but there's also this past event that where the ripples also are rolling through our consciousness. So it's like the ripples from the past and the ripples from the future, and we're caught between the two, and it's like we're trying to ride the wave into the future, but there's the corresponding what do you call that with the wave, the underpull, there's a thing under the wave.
Isn't that undertow?
The undertow, yes.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called.
The undertow is pulling us into the past. Like we can't actually let the future event draw us to it until we're fully surrendered, and we can't fully surrender until we've allowed ourselves to be powerless, to experience that original trauma of being utterly powerless. Because, when consciousness comes into form, as it's coming into form, consciousness that's without form is neither powerful nor powerless, really, right? It just is.
Right.
But as it's coming into form, as it's becoming a separate thing, then it's becoming completely dependent on and just subject to its environment. And of course, you know, just literally speaking, biologically speaking, a fetus is completely powerless. It can't actually do anything to be born or to eat or to express itself or anything. It's just waiting.
So are you suggesting that the experience of going from like a non-local to a localized consciousness like that, right from the moment of inception or exactly whenever that happens for the developing fetus, that in itself is an even earlier trauma than anything else?
Well, I don't know if it seems to me that being powerless means that one is potentially going to be traumatized because you've got no defenses. So, but what I don't know is if just being powerless itself is traumatic. It seems like it needn't be, like in a perfect world.
Right.
But then I'm very suspicious of the whole idea of a perfect world.
Right. Understandably so, I think.
Yeah. So it may be that it is inevitable, and it may be that's part of the like the individuation process, which begins whenever it begins, but pre-birth and for all we know preconception, you know, like monad souls and all that, certainly begins before we can remember, right, before we had thought or language or self-awareness.
To
remember it, by definition, individuation begins, you know, before you're an individual. So it seems, and this is something that Strieber's always talking about, that a certain element of stress or trauma is inevitable and even necessary for individuation or growth.
That seems to make some sense from that perspective. I can understand that.
So, but I mean, the extent that it's necessary is unknown, I think. And,
it's definitely seems to be part of the process that makes human beings in general the way they are presently. I think we can say that much, at least. Whether it's totally innate to the species in general, I don't know if anyone can ascertain, at least not at this point.
Well, I guess we've got the animals to compare to as best we can, but that's tricky because we can't see inside their psyches. But my guess is that an element of trauma is part of growth, an effective part of growth, so long as each trauma can be assimilated and integrated before the next.
I think maybe even more primary than that, one you could say that, you know, trauma transforms whatever subject is experiencing it. I mean, in whether or not it's growth in the sense of, you know, healthful and so something developing towards a holistic sense, or is it a growth like, you know, some horrible mutation kind of growth,
right.
But it's a transformation nevertheless. And then definitely the process to consciously integrate that seems to have some bearing on the success of relative success of that transformation in its whatever its surrounding context might be.
Yeah, I think it has to do with not resisting it. That's my guess.
Wow, that which would be, I would think, hard for anyone to do at almost any age. Wouldn't you think?
I think that we're sort of biologically. Well, I guess I was going to say that we're biologically programmed to go with the flow, but you could also argue the opposite. We're biologically programmed to contract in the cold and to resist. So actually, I'm not sure. The honest answer there.
It could be. I can see where it could be, but yeah.
So maybe it's not biologically. I mean, this is we're getting into the eternal question, really, of, you know, what is there besides biology? Because neither of us here, I think, are satisfied with a purely biological or materialistic view of experience. Like, consciousness isn't just a byproduct of...
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Definitely, I mean, there's...
So this is why I come to the psyche.
Doesn't explain it for me. Yeah.
This is why the psyche has become such a sort of... I have this need to really emphasize the reality of the psyche.
I was really taken by, just a little bit ago, the way that you were speaking of the experience of being a young child, where... I think you used the word psyche in this context. You might have said consciousness. Perhaps it was kind of interchangeable for a moment. I'm not sure. Isn't yet completely embodied, because it hasn't had a splitting experience that splits it off into a more of a discrete individuation process for that individual. And that actually, thinking about it like that, actually gave me like a spark of hope that perhaps, you know, I don't know exactly how to address it, though, but I mean, I know that, like, the impressions I have from before, the memories I have of being, like, a more concretely discrete person separate from the other people in the house and from the other objects around me, the impressions I have from before that is sort of like... It really is kind of like I'm not completely just in my body, but I'm kind of everywhere, and I'm like kind of filling up everything. Mm. But there's no language there, really, and there's no real differentiation between myself and someone else, and it's kind of hard to tell where my body begins and ends. And sometimes I felt like that in some of my later experiences that were triggered by migraines or stress or what have you. But the older I got, it didn't seem as blissful. It seemed more painful than anything else. But it's like, it's hard to imagine, like, well, maybe not hard to imagine. I shouldn't even say that even. It's something quite distinct to imagine a species or members of a species like growing into physical maturity, but retaining that state of oneness. And to me, that is somewhat, at least analogous, if not equivalent, to what I think Freud first, but then Norman O. Brown uses the phrase a lot too, the polymorphous perversity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, I feel like I have impressions of being really, really young and like having tastes of that. That might be close to the oceanic feeling, as other people would describe it. I think Freud uses that term somewhere else too. Maybe it's not the same thing, but. I don't know. I'm thinking about like being adults and still being in that state. That would sound like paradise or something. But it sounds totally improbable too. But then you think about other animal kingdoms. They definitely seem to share more of a group consciousness, almost more manifestly than we seem to notice it in ourselves.
Yes.
And then the fact that we don't notice it in ourselves as much, to me, that seems rather unnatural. But it's hard to engage many people in conversation about that.
Well,
a lot of people don't want to talk about being a fetus or having a placenta or having the umbilical cord cut either. I thought other people would be interested in talking about that stuff and like reexamining it, but people get really weirded out when you start bringing that stuff up, I found out.
Well, it's funny because what you're talking about is something, as you point out in your use of language, you use the word notice, to notice that collective experience, that collective body that we're part of. So it is something that's already happening that we are experiencing, because that's the bedrock, maybe. Mm-hmm. That is the ground of our experience, is that even though we may be individuating psychically, psychologically, spiritually even, and that separates us from the animals and gives us this experience of being separate from each other, we're not separate from either.
Right. I have to say, maybe the distinction for me is that as an adult, because it definitely was in my 20s and 30s, I definitely had some experiences on psychedelics where it sure seemed like I was re-experiencing or maybe actively connecting back to that group mind kind of situation. And it was not blissful at all. It was absolutely horrifying and terrifying to like really sort of be present with the consciousness of everyone else, just the people in the room, let alone, you know, everyone else in the city around me and the country and the rest of the globe.
Yeah.
It was hard to really get into a bliss situation. It was ended up really being shattering most of the time.
Well, it's reminded me of something I just read by Jung, where he talks about how consciousness develops in us. And so as children, as infants, we're not conscious, not self-conscious. The conscious bodily, we're conscious the way the animals are conscious, we're having sensory sensation.
We're aware, I guess.
Yeah.
But my impressions from that time is not aware of a separate, discrete self, though. No.
Right. And so we develop, ideally, and this is about neoteny, you know, ideally it's gradually over time as children, because we're in this environment, safe environment of play, so we can develop self-awareness very gradually and over time, and in a way that is just natural and organic and playful, as opposed to in a way that our survival depends upon it. So then the ego, self-consciousness, would develop not as a defense system so much as just a kind of natural transitional tool between unconsciousness and full self-awareness. And what Jung was talking about was that in terms of decisions, like a child, again, if the environment is right and wholesome and protective, and the child's being guided, the child doesn't have to make decisions. Even when it's developing self-awareness around the age of four, even all the way up to adolescence, it's becoming more and more self-aware, but it doesn't ideally need to make decisions, because that's what the adults do. Mm-hmm. And the consciousness in this specific sense of self-awareness grows through decision-making, but also stress. The more decisions we have to make, the more stress. The more stress, the more consciousness increases. The more consciousness increases, the more decisions we have to make.
Yeah, definitely feels that way.
Yeah, right. Totally. That's my experience too. But social anxiety is a huge part of that, because it just feels like there's all these decisions, whether to nod, whether to smile, and it's all... It all seems trivial in a larger context, but when you're in it...
Right, exactly. At least that's been my experience too.
Yeah. So to finish anyway, Jung's thought, there was that nature isn't helping us in this, because nature wants us to stay unconscious. Because like an athlete will tell you, you know, the organism functions better when it's unconscious, when the mind doesn't interfere with it.
Right. The peak experience.
And so unconsciousness in what we're talking about would correlate with group consciousness. Not group mind, because that's a social thing, but the collective consciousness. So a child that's a fetus, and even when it's born, it's enmeshed in the mother's psyche, so it's still hooked into this larger psyche. It's unconscious insofar as it's not individuated or differentiated from this larger psychic environment in which it's in. And that has to do with it also not being fully in its body. But it becomes more in its body and it more aware of the body, and the body has to survive, it's got these biological imperatives. Of course, we have to experience ourselves as separate from our environment, because fire burns and ice freezes, and you know, which berries are safe and which aren't. That's all absolutely essential to our survival, that degree of separation.
Right.
I think this is our challenge, like we're caught between Eden, lost Eden, and what's the place we're all trying to get to in the myths? Arcadia?
Oh, okay.
Whatever they call it, doesn't matter. But we all, you know, all the religions present this return to paradise or the promised land, I guess. So how the gypsies describe themselves, that they come from a place that no longer exists, and they're trying to reach a place that doesn't exist yet. That's us, right? We're in this liminal state.
Yeah.
But I think that's arrested development, because I think that liminal state is natural for a child that's growing into an adult, because it's moving from unconsciousness to enlightened consciousness, or it's trying to, but that doesn't happen. So then we remain trapped in that in-between state.
You know, sometimes, I guess, it's only been recently, maybe in the past couple of years, but the last little bit you said, sometimes I even question that lately.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I wonder whether it wouldn't be better to be more like an animal, and that maybe this whole race to evolve, or whatever you want to call it, I'm putting that in quotation marks too, big time, mm-hmm. or to achieve these things for civilization, maybe all of that is just completely neurotic and just totally symptomatic of some serious trauma having happened to everybody in the past.
Yeah.
Basically scared us out of our, you know, scared us into some kind of transformation, and we're not sure where we came from or what we are now.
Right. Well, I think that's compatible with what I was saying, really. I mean, I don't disagree with it. It's just that nature doesn't make mistakes, because if it did, what would we compare it to? You know, what would be the right way?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe we're some kind of freak mutation, but I still maintain we can't go back. We can't be animals there. Then anyway.
Oh yeah, I understand that. I agree with that as well.
Yeah. So then we're kind of caught, aren't we? Because I also agree with what you're saying, is that the race to evolve or put one's hands on one's own evolution is doomed to frustration and failure. Also.
Sure seems like it lately, to me at least.
So then it's the third thing, the third way, which is both. It's going both ways at the same time. It's like letting the past come back into the present, and letting oneself be drawn into the future, whatever that holds. Like it seems to be mostly a passive process, I think.
I know that for me in the past few years, just getting more concretely in my body and just feeling more embodied on a regular basis is definitely, to me, that has felt like the most forward development I've taken ever.
Yeah.
But in a way, I started out at first just trying to kind of what felt like stepping backward just to ground myself, but has ended up feeling like a huge step forward now.
Right. Yeah, well, I've had similar experience. I haven't necessarily been doing things specifically to ground me, but I've definitely been letting go of the things that were ungrounding me.
Yeah, that's. Turned out that those kind of things ended up like running away from me before I realized I had to give them up. And then when they ran away, I was like, "What the hell just happened?"
Yeah.
It took me a while to figure out. Oh yeah, that was one of the best things that could ever happen to me.
I mean, you touched on it earlier when you talked about the consciousness prior to embodiment and how it splits in order to become embodied. And I didn't want to interrupt, but I did want to say that I think that does happen, that in order for the psyche to become at all kind of connected or to inhabit the body at all. It has to split. But I think that that relates to the trauma and the fact that the body is so traumatized that it closes and it contracts. And so the psyche can't actually enter all the way into it the way that it's supposed to. And so the only way, this is a whole new theory. I've never put this in these terms, but the only way that the psyche can at least have some sort of embodiment is by fragmenting, and that fragment then can at least enter into the body. But I think that the larger part of the psyche does remain outside of the body, and that's kind of the nut of the problem, is that we're split, psychosomatically split.
I honestly, this is just part of, you know, my personal BS, as Robert Anton Wilson would say. But I'm getting this from some coaching from Ronald Lange here, that this primarily comes as a result of cutting the umbilical cord. It's literally, we're going from being conscious inside the placenta and inside of our newborn body to suddenly having part of ourselves like, they're cutting through two vital nerves right there. It's like it sends an electric spasm through our body. How could that not fuck us up?
So if we think of, but if you think of how that was done in more primitive cultures, the mother would not only bite the umbilical cord off with her teeth, but then she would eat the placenta.
Now, see, in lots of other cultures, they had all these taboos about doing anything with the umbilical cord, and they let it fall off on its own. And then, of course, they had all these rituals about you have to bury it. You bury it underneath a tree that you're planting anew, and that tree, as well as the guardian spirit of the placenta, is how they used to kind of talk about it. That is the survival of that tree is totally connected to the survival of this child now. Wow. And whether or not that child is going to be able to find his guardian spirit when he goes through the whole initiation ritual as a teenager.
Wow.
And having had a background in studying that kind of stuff from early on, when I was really into mythology and stuff like that, you know, and then later, many years later, connecting it with what Lange was presenting is like this medical, statistical, you know, observable evidence of what happens in Western birthing practices. It was just like, this, like, who started birthing babies like this? I think it was actually the Romans or something like that. It was some crazy Roman way of doing it, and it became the norm somehow. I've never actually been able to find a concrete answer as far as what culture introduced cutting the umbilical cord, but it sounds like a pretty dumb idea. But it happened to all of us.
Yeah. Well,
so it makes a lot of sense, and to me, in that context, it makes a lot of sense that the psyche is then, it's not fully embodied because it's gone through, you know, seriously, you know, nerve shattering experience, like a literal splitting of itself. Almost, I mean, it's really kind of a physical splitting of itself. It really is.
Right. Well, yeah, that's
anyway,
a new item of information. That
that's where my mind is.
it brought to mind Philip K. Dick again and his experience, which was parallel with Elvis's, the king, of having a twin who died before he was born, and how he remained in contact with that twin.
Yeah, Lange goes through a whole like section of this one book where he goes through all these myths of the twin and stuff like that, and connecting it back to experiences of being self and placenta in the womb.
So then you've got the idea of the double.
Yep, the double, the doppelganger. You have the astral double, especially connected by an umbilical cord, literally. And like to me, like when I have been in that what I would call out of body experience, it was like being an amorphous blob. You could be any shape you wanted. You could do anything you want, but you have to somehow. You have to know that. You have to learn that. Like I didn't know that right away when I got there. To me, it was like many years of like being in that state before I started kind of figuring out that it was like navigable.
Mm-hmm.
But what is that? Is that my own kind of crazy neurosis, psychosis? I don't know. But I decided that I'm going to at least try to write it down in as concrete language as I can. And I don't know, maybe someday someone can make sense out of it.
Isn't that your job?
I don't know. No, not anymore. Now I feel like if I just keep record of at least what the fuck I experienced, maybe it'll help someone else someday. because I feel like that's the only thing I can really do is I feel like the other writers that I got so much out of, including some of your stuff, thank you very much, like, you know, maybe they didn't become rich and famous, maybe they died poor and penniless and miserable like I might, but nevertheless, what they experienced and the record that they left, it touched me, it changed me, and it somehow made me feel connected to a larger community that I have never had really experienced in the flesh and in real material life, unfortunately.
Mm.
So I don't know what else I can do except for basically to repay that, except for just kind of do the same. And I don't know really what else to do with the rest of my life except for to do that, to be honest.
Well, that was something I wrote yesterday, actually, was that writing is becoming more, I'm becoming more and more aware that writing isn't about trying to communicate some truth, but simply to connect.
Yeah.
Firstly, the part of myself, my own unconscious that's communicating, or my double, maybe, or to the collective and or the collective, and then potentially to connect to the reader who reads those words and feels connected to me through them, and I'm going to experience that. And these conversations also, like, they've come out of this writing project, and I'm connecting with people that in some cases I haven't connected to before or in many years. And ostensibly, yeah, it's to try and work out what's going on and what's true and what's not true, and that's all potentially quite enjoyable and even satisfying. But
it's about connecting with other people and, like, actually having, you know, engaging, interactive, satisfying, you know, relation with another human being. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I mean, ultimately, that was always in the background of, you know, why I decided to take writing seriously, because I intended for other people to read it and to somehow, you know, connect with others that possibly were more like me than the other individuals in the towns that I grew up in that I could not relate to very well. Mm-hmm. Maybe in part that's worked, because look, we're having a conversation. Like, I feel like I have more in common with you than just about most of the people I've ever known in real life. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. And so, I don't know, to me that's pretty cool to actually be talking to someone that I actually feel like I can relate to.
Sure, yeah. That's
And I can just say exactly what I mean and not have to, like, you know, second guess my words or hold back. It's really relieving, actually, to be honest.
Well, that's good. I was going to say, because if the internet is a sort of course model for the collective unconscious becoming conscious, then it's kind of similar in the way that one follows certain threads or thoughts in order to explore something or understand something. And same on the internet, you know, we found each other through that common interest. We were looking for the same things, and so we bumped into each other, right?
Yeah, pretty much, I think so.
So in that model, you and I would have already been connected and in communication at some level before we found each other on the internet.
You have arrived.
Without the culture addressing this in a manner that it can... in an organized way, gain the information that's available and process it with the means that we have. And I refer to primarily to using scientific method to address it, and doing things like sequential studies of the psychological makeup of the people who have had the experience. Psychological makeup of the people who have had the experience. It's been discovered that the brain functions differently when it is asked to recall something that was an actual physical event, as opposed to something that the individual involved only believed was physical. Only believed was physical.
The thunder. All the people are fucking.